Good day. Welcome to New Books in Music podcast. My name is Stephen Lee Naish, and I'm your host today. Richard Power Said is a writer and documentary filmmaker based in London. His first book, 1997, The Future That Never Happened, which is published by Zed Books, is a brilliant dissection of British culture in the late 1990s. The book's scope is broad, from music to art, from media to politics. There is a sense that those living during these times never had it so good, yet somehow we let it all slip away. It's my pleasure to introduce Richard Power Said. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Yep, it's my pleasure. So firstly, let's start off with some background on yourself. So your educational background and your writing career.
So I come from a social scientific background, and, you know, part of what this book is about kind of taking things like pop music seriously as something that has a big impact upon our society and really tells us about the kind of culture we live in, but always trying to do that in a way that isn't too dry and, you know, like retains a lot of the fun and the excitement that pop music has in it.
Yeah, well, I definitely got that from reading your book, so yeah.
That's very nice of you. And then, yeah, but as a journalist, I've mostly made documentaries about and written about current affairs subjects, often very political ones. You know, last few years I've been focusing on Brexit a lot of the time. And so this book was sort of bringing together these different sides, you know, wanting to talk about why Britain is how it is now. And, you know, that's not just a kind of parochial national story. It's the reason that Britain is experiencing enormous upheaval now, and, you know, Brexit's the most extreme and obvious example of that, but it's by no means the only one. You know, we've got this astonishing rise of Jeremy Corbyn, a socialist, you know, who could very well be an enormously popular prime minister very soon. You know, that kind of upheaval in Britain is absolutely the same sort of thing that's happening over in the States with, you know, you've got Bernie Sanders, you've got Donald Trump. We're seeing something very similar happen all across the world.
Well, we're definitely going to talk about Brexit a little bit later, but I just wanted to ask, on the back cover of the book, you ask, 1997, what do you remember? So 1997 for me was a pretty big year because I was 16 turning 17. I was like mega into Britpop. I had my first real kind of my first kind of real adult experiences. I went on, you know, it was the first time I got served in a pub. First time I went to a club. I went on holiday with my friends and stuff like that. It was just such a great year. But I wanted to ask, where were you in 1997? And what were you doing that year? And what memories do you have of that time?
You know what? I was even younger. I was 9 years old in 97. And which kind of surprises people. They're like, what a strange book to write. But actually, it you know, it makes total sense for me because the point is, I remember the Spice Girls. I remember Oasis. I remember New Labour coming to power. I remember, really remember Princess Diana dying, but I didn't understand any of these things. You know, they were extraordinary key moments in my childhood, but I didn't really know what was going on. So writing this book was about kind of going back to these exciting memories, but trying to work out, like, what did happen? And, you know, all the stories that we tell ourselves in our kind of like our national history of our recent past, are those stories that we tell ourselves quite accurate? Or actually, you know, maybe we should be reevaluating our recent past a bit. And, you know, I was talking so much about what the current political upheaval is. Well, the point is, that's relevant to 97, because looking back at what happened to us over the last couple of decades tells us how we got to this point.
Yeah, well, I would totally agree with that. So let's just get to your book. So whilst 1997 isn't necessarily a music book, you know, this is a music book podcast, but it does contain chapters on the Spice Girls and Britpop.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, you know, the music bit of it is it's a massive section of the book, and it's a really, really, for me, it's one of the really fun bits.
Yeah, no, it's huge. And, you know, I think for me, it acted as the gateway drug into the rest of the book. So if you can spare a few moments on this one to discuss the Spice Girls and your chapter entitled Girl Power, if you could give us a little bit of insight into the impact they had on 90s culture and where you think it went wrong for them.
So, I mean, the first thing is the Spice Girls were we perhaps forget just how huge they were. They were kind of Beatles-level world domination, but just for a much, much shorter period than the Beatles. And I mean, I think we can also say, like, maybe the music wasn't quite as good as the Fab Four either. But the point is that they were that huge in global pop culture. And I'm particularly interested in the Spice Girls because they really reflect the extraordinary optimism and the kind of liberal modern optimism of 97, which, you know, maybe is most famously embodied by Tony Blair. But the point is, it was happening right beyond politics into the whole of the culture. And the thing about the Spice Girls is they did this extraordinary thing. They were marketed with the slogans of 1970s feminism, of the women's liberation movement, the future is female. We're maybe quite used now to radical politics getting kind of co-opted to sell whichever random product is on the shelves today. But back in the late 90s, this was a really, really kind of a strange thing to do, to use an ideology that was so pervasively mocked and which was so widely seen as being uncool, feminism, to say, actually, no, there's something incredibly like strong and vibrant, to say we can make it cool, to say we can use it to sell stuff. There's obviously something very cynical going on there, but something very unusual and something very, very characteristically 97, trying to bring radical things into the mainstream. And the question is, you know, does that have actually some like a small progressive impact on our society, or does it just get completely exploited for the sake of people who've already got a lot of power?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of your book actually deals with that idea, doesn't it? This idea of like watered down radical ideas, I suppose. And yeah, for me, I mean, I remember the Spice Girls so well. I mean, I was huge Britpop fan, but like, you know, the Spice Girls were there, and I, you know what, they had my time, you know. It was I didn't ignore them just because they were a pop artist. They were obviously something way bigger than just that. So yeah,
and you know, their pop songs were really well constructed pop songs. They've got great hooks. The videos are, you know, really stand. Most of the videos really stand up to the test of time. They, you know, the Spice Girls had actually just not that many hits. You know, they had like, I can't remember the exact number. It's something like only 8 really big singles. I think all but one of them went to number one. Yeah. I think one went to number two. The rest went to number one. They had a huge impact, and I guess the question is, does that huge commercial impact then get reflected in, you know, did girl power, which is their kind of watered down version of feminism, did it still manage to have a positive impact, or did it get really counteracted by the fact that, A, the Spice Girls were in many ways presenting really kind of like reactionary ideas about, you know, like women should be conventionally attractive in this very specific way, and you know, also the kind of feminism they were representing was a very kind of individualist one, you know, a kind of Thatcherite feminism of you've got to fight for yourself, not you've got to have solidarity with other women. And although there was maybe a bit of the solidarity element as well, but also, you know, another problem with girl power that feminist critics identified, and perhaps this is more even more important, is that a lot of the time it was used as a marketing gimmick to exploit little girls, to kind of, you know, persuade them that they were in power and therefore they should go buy this or that product with the Spice Girls logo on it. You know, that's not feminism. That's like its free market antithesis. So there's a, you know, that's an ongoing question, really. You know, in all politics, it's, you know, how much do you compromise with the mainstream? If you wanna change the world, how much are you gonna get involved with people who you really disagree with? It's a big question for anyone.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a huge question right now. I mean, with the rise of Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, you know, I've seen him change over the past 2 years to being actually a very credible leader. Certainly, but you know, that's because he has engaged with the mainstream and watered. Well, maybe he hasn't. I don't know, but watered down his kind of sort of staunch socialism, which he was always very known for. You know what? We'll get to him.
Yeah,
I'm sure we will.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah, I always felt that the Spice Girls. Well, you know, it was Jerry Halliwell who said, you know, Margaret Thatcher was the first Spice Girl. I always felt that was just a huge, huge problem, you know, really did at the time.
I think quite a lot of the Spice Girls themselves were really angry about that. Mel C, and I think Mel B as well, you know, have come out as Labour supporters and left-wingers at various times. And they were really annoyed about being identified with the Conservative Party. Jerry Halliwell has absolutely... held on to her conservative ideals, and she was very critical of the European Union back in the late 90s as well. You know, yeah. Well, I think, you know, she was very critical of Blair and his kind of pro-European perspective in this that they were interviewed in The Spectator, which for your non-British listeners, I should explain, is a fairly right-wing current affairs magazine, very stylish, very well written, but with often some pretty reactionary perspectives in there. And this famous historian, Simon Sebag Montefiore, interviewed them. It kind of seemed like a bit of a joke interview, perhaps, but Jerry Halliwell made this perhaps kind of offhand, certainly very well chosen comment about how Margaret Thatcher had been the original Spice Girl. And what it did was it was exactly the right moment for them, because it was when they were just starting to be not just like a kiddie pop band, but something a bit more pervasive. It was, I think, December 1996. And what it allowed was for any political journalist who was kind of writing a slightly boring story about this or that, you know, they, over the next few months, so many political news stories had kind of zigzag, or wannabe, or whatever it was, some kind of girl power related slogan slipped into the headline, and a kind of tangential reference to the Spice Girls being Tories made their political story just like a little bit more interesting. And, you know, that's amazing marketing. That's amazing advertising. It got the Spice Girls being noticed in a totally different section of the media. And it was a really key part of how the Spice Girls went from being basically a kiddie pop band to being a much more kind of like culturally pervasive force, which they were for another 12, 15 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty short-lived. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. I don't know what happened to the philosophy of Zigga Zigar, but I think it's due for a comeback.
Well, a very coherent and sophisticated philosophy, I'm sure we can all agree.
Absolutely.
That said, yeah, I'm kind of like making fun, but what's happening when someone goes Zigga Zigar in a song? It sounds like totally fluffy and superficial or whatever, but part of what's going on there is Mel B, Scary Spice as she was known, was being assertive, was being aggressive in a sexualized way. And this was something not totally unknown, but relatively unusual, definitely in the kind of like middle of the mainstream pop, for women to show themselves to be really sexually assertive and in control of their own lives. And, you know, I think there was something very meaningful there. And it means that we can't just totally dismiss this idea that the Spice Girls were feminists, or that they might have had a feminist impact. You know, there's something more complex going on than just a pop band.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the other chapter that is also about music, which is Oasis. On the cover of the book, you have the very infamous photo of Oasis's Noel Gallagher and the British Prime Minister Tony Blair shaking hands. So this for me was arguably the handshake that ended any sense of rebellion or excitement that Oasis had had. What do you think that image represents? Was this the beginning, the end for Oasis?
I think it was a sign that both Britpop, and especially Oasis had come to this moment where they were both, like I was saying about the Spice Girls in that year, culturally pervasive. You know, they were a total kind of orthodoxy. But in that moment of reaching the very, very center of the mainstream and becoming the thing that everyone was talking about, they also lost the thing that had made them so exciting. And what was so important about Britpop was that it was trying to say something authentic about Britain. It was trying to be an expression of grassroots feeling. It was trying to give voice to experiences that have been ignored by pop culture for a very long time. That can, you know, maybe that sounds a little bit idealistic or a little bit theoretical, but the fact is that's something very special, and we forget how unusual that was. We forget how throughout the 70s, 80s, and a lot of the 90s, pop music had been so dominated by American styles and American voices, American accents, or kind of transatlantic, middle of the Atlantic accents. And of course, you know, I love American music and pop music, but the point is that there were times when other things were being kind of obscured by that in British pop music. And for Britpop to arrive and say, no, let's talk about our lives and let's talk about our experiences, that was really special. And it was at exactly the moment that reaches the height of its popularity that also anything kind of rebellious and authentic about that gets taken away, because, you know, there's the king of Britpop hanging out with the totally middle of the road prime minister sipping champagne. You know, it was a big disappointment for a lot of people seeing Noel Gallagher in the state drawing rooms of Downing Street, nervously smiling.
He does look very nervous. Yeah.
Yeah. They both look pretty worried. I mean, Tony Blair was very, very excited about this celebrity assignation. You know, he was rubbing shoulders with cool people, and he was getting to look by hanging out with someone like Noel Gallagher. Most of your listeners probably know Noel Gallagher was from a very, very difficult working class background, Irish working class in Manchester. And Tony Blair, again, you know, I think some of your listeners will know this, but others won't. Tony Blair had taken the Labour Party, which was a relatively traditional socialist party, and he had taken it significantly to the right. He'd really separated it from its historical relationship with the trade unions, with the labour movement, with nationalised industries. And so someone like Noel Gallagher represented for Tony Blair, being friends with him, and that Tony Blair could say, no, look, see, I'm still kind of connected to the grassroots. I'm still connected to what was historically the origins of my party and the people who vote for it. And so it, you know, kind of being friends with Britpop musicians was like a symbolic substitute for Tony Blair actually having any left-wing policies, a lot of which have disappeared.
Yeah, I think that's definitely correct. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I was, Oasis were a big band for me because I was dead in the middle there of when they released What's the Story of Morning Glory, I was maybe 15, 16, and then it was just, they were just so huge. But for some reason, even though I was too young to vote for Blair, just that image of him in that, in those rooms, you know, where so many decisions were being made, and it just, I don't know, for me, it was a bad moment for them. And actually, you know, that kind of leads into another question, I suppose, because this was also the year that Oasis released their record Be Here Now, which was arguably the most overhyped record of their career and maybe even of all time by any band. It's seen as a signifier to the end of Britpop. What do you think the problem was with that record, that one in particular?
I mean, there were a lot of problems with it. You know, Be Here Now got so hyped, partly because What's the Story Morning Glory, which is an incredible album that precedes it. You know, Morning Glory has got Wonderwall, got Don't Look Back in Anger. It's an extraordinary record, and but it had been kind of overlooked by the music press. They'd kind of described it as being slightly disappointing, but then it had built so much popularity with you know, with Oasis's fans, and the music critics basically realised that they'd got it wrong. So they were primed when Be Here Now was released. They were primed to give it a good review. But actually, lots of things have gone really wrong with its production. I mean, even writing it, you know, Noel Gallagher was living this incredibly kind of luxurious lifestyle, hanging out on tropical beaches with celebrities. He, you know, arguably was not in the right place socially and culturally, you know, occasionally meeting Tony Blair at an awards ceremony. He wasn't necessarily in the right place to be writing a record that felt as immediate and important as the LPs that had preceded it. And then when they started actually recording the album, that would, the songs that would eventually make up Be Here Now, there were all of these fights that he was having with Liam, which probably didn't help very much. They were taking massive amounts of coke, you know, much more than they even had before. And what they did was, the production, you know, I'd say to people, go back to Morning Glory and listen to it compared to Be Here Now. And what you'll see is that the production of Be Here Now is so much more layered, it's so much more dense. You've got so many guitars on top of each other, on top of each other, on top of each other, especially on a record like Do You Know What I Mean, which is the first single that came out of it. And it's just, it's too much. These songs, which, you know, potentially could have been decent Oasis songs, they kind of just get ruined by being too Oasis-y.
Yeah, I seem to remember Do You Know What I Mean, when that was released. That's like 9 minutes long, isn't it? That's a really long song. For Oasis, who are, you know, known as just a raucous rock and roll band, a nine-minute song is actually, I mean, Radiohead did a nine-minute song the same year. I think that's right. Okay, Computer. Yeah, came out in 97. Yeah, and that was fine for them. But for Oasis, yeah, a nine-minute song is not something to be, you know, kind of enjoyed, I don't think.
No, not unless you're willing to, you know, if Noel had taken his songwriting up a step, if he'd really pushed himself with his writing, then maybe he could have made something that was complex enough to warrant 9 minutes, you know. But the fact is, he for a very long time had an extraordinary talent for writing, you know, those kind of punchy songs which have just got a few brilliant ideas in them and then they're over. But yeah, a 9 minute song has to develop so much more. You've got, there's too much space for just a couple of ideas, a couple of hooks. You know, what is that? That is an image of, well, you could call it arrogance. Of course, what's really exciting about Oasis was their arrogance, was their brute force. But if it's not matched by brilliant pop songs, if it's not matched by seeming rebellious, which it can't be if you're hanging out with the Prime Minister. But then arrogance stops looking exciting and it starts to be a bit of a turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least, you know, with when Radiohead released Paranoid Android, they had the decency to make it almost four different songs in one. I think, you know...
Right, right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Was just one long slog of a song. Yeah.
It was. So, you know what? I won't pretend that I don't have quite fond memories of it. I recently re-watched the video, which is them touching down in a helicopter, military mm-hmm. helicopter in some sort of like post-war dystopia, and in kind of like lots of slow-mo, then kind of like trudging through and then slinging their guitars over their necks and really slamming into this song, and all of these crowds of people watching them holding huge orange flares. And not gonna lie, I love that stuff.
Oh yeah.
it's not their best song, but it still gives me a lot of pleasure, and I would sing along to that song.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting because there is almost like a parallel between New Labour and Oasis, because both of them had this very kind of, well, appealing to the working classes. But by 1997, with them meeting, it kind of, you know, it kind of was lost a little bit. So do you think like that meeting with that whole event that that Noel Gallagher attended, was that kind of like the beginning of New Labour's gradual demise, or did that come a little later?
I think that came later. That was July 1997 that Tony Blair had this star-studded party at Downing Street. Actually, you know, his greatest moment came a couple of months later. This awful tragedy of Princess Diana dying, which is another chapter in the book, the way that that had a huge fallout in Britain's culture and in its politics. You know, that was Tony Blair's, in some ways, you know, it's a very cynical thing to say, but it was his greatest moment. It was the moment when he was able to really kind of harness what was happening in Britain and use it to his own advantage. So no, I don't think that was the beginning of the end for New Labour. Most people date New Labour's demise to 2003, when Blair uses all of his political skills to take Britain into the Iraq War. Actually, I would say that it kind of happens a bit before that. Labour's demise, because ultimately, you know, New Labour failed because they were appealing only to actually quite a narrow band of people. They were always very good at triangulating the floating voter, but throughout their different elections that they won, voting turnout fell and fell and fell. Basically, working class people who had traditionally voted Labour, just kind of a lot of people just stopped voting because New Labour was such a turnoff, because they were so clearly not putting forward the best policies for ordinary people, and because it seemed to people that there was no difference between Labour and the Tories.
Mm. And let's not forget as well that a few years ago, Noel Gallagher wasn't the only Britpop star to meet a prime minister. Alex James from Blur had David Cameron at his cheese shop. times don't change.
Times don't change. They're apparently good friends. That was always a really big tension within Blur, because Alex James was always very kind of unpolitical, and then eventually turned out to be mates of David Cameron, whereas other members of Blur were much more left wing and much more kind of politically critical. And you know, I think that kind of all the criticisms that you can make of their album, you know, the way that he's taken his music over since Britpop, you know, that's really a sign of someone who keeps pushing himself, who keeps asking questions. And it's true of Graham Hoxton as well, of course. You know, but both of them were, you know, they love making pop music. They love making songs that are listenable and people want to engage with. But they also really want to innovate and they want to push themselves and change what they do. You know, of course, Damon Albarn has his enormously successful side project, Gorillaz. He has Africa Express, which is his very long-running series of concerts and records with artists from around the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. He, you know, I saw him last year playing with the Syrian National Orchestra, which is a really extraordinary, very moving moment. You know, yeah, he pushes himself forward artistically, and I think that reflects someone who's become much more socially and politically
engaged. Yeah, I would say that he's definitely pushed out of that Britpop bubble now, a long time ago, in fact. Yeah, and also let's not forget as well David Rowntree, who is the drummer for Blur. Did he run as an MP for Labour a couple of years ago?
He ran for the Labour Party, actually, in the constituency that I was at the time. Two cities. So, cities of London, Westminster. So, yeah, he ran as the candidate there.
Okay, well, let's move on. So let's talk a little about some of the other aspects of the book. So could you tell us about the chapter on the young British artists who were known as the YBAs? So who were they and what did they represent? And again, how did they fail?
So the YBAs were kind of Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin, and these very exciting artists of the early 90s to mid 90s, to late 90s. They were emerging at the end of the 80s, but they only really became huge household names in 97. And what they did with their art was they were trying to express some really kind of shocking ideas, but in very kind of clear, punchy ways. People might remember Damien Hirst's Shark in a Tank of Formaldehyde or Tracy Emin's Unmade Bed. These were images that in a second immediately communicated a feeling to you. You didn't have to do any kind of like careful critical interpretation. You know, the image of the bed, of the unmade bed, was an image of emotional turmoil. The image of the shark was the image of danger and of death. And this kind of very easily accessible contemporary art, you know, it was supposed to be bringing the experimental avant-garde and a population of ordinary people who didn't necessarily have an artistic education together. You know, finally, it's the intellectuals and the masses together fighting the establishment. That's the idea of this kind of art. And, you know, it fundamentally failed because actually the Brit artists, the YBAs, were so concerned with just kind of shocking people and getting attention. And for a lot of them, you know, that was the primary route towards making money. And of course, that's never the way to persuade people to be critical and angry with, except, you know, helps people be angry with them, the British artists themselves.
Yeah, I feel like some of their art, it passed me by at the time, but, you know, it has more in common with marketing and with advertising than actual art. And this this chapter made me go back and watch. You described Damien Hirst in your book as a commercially viable brand, which I think is absolutely right. But this made me go back and watch an interview with him and the comedian Noel Fielding. They were walking around Damien Hirst's kind of retrospective exhibition from a few years ago, I think. And, you know, Hirst's entire body language and his mannerisms and the way he talks about his own art, wasn't that as of an artist? He was almost like a salesman trying to promote his brand, trying to just promote his art, not as art, but as something else. And I read that chapter and I was like, I've got to go back and watch this because I've got to see Hirst do this again. And yeah, it's just exactly right. And Noel Fielding there, he's just, Noel Fielding is not a known commodity in North America, but in the UK, he's kind of an institution.
Surreal, ironic comedian.
Yeah. And he's just, he's buying it, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of, a lot to say about Hirst there being more of a marketeer as opposed to an artist. But
And he, he tries to kind of use that. He treats his own obsession with money, ironically, one of the later Damien Hirst artworks that some of your listeners may remember is it's a human skull, which has been cast in platinum. It's the actual skull, isn't it, which has then had covered onto it, it's entirely covered with diamonds, it's this image of death and money. And of course it asks the question of it reminds you that you can't take your material wealth with you when you die. So it's an image of the futility of wealth. It's a critique of being obsessed with wealth, and of therefore potentially capitalism. But creating this artwork and then selling it in the very clever way that he did, basically nobody was going to buy it for as much money as he wanted for it. So secretly, he and several other different individuals and institutions got the money together and bought it themselves, which means that, therefore the Damien Hirst brand lives on, and the price of his artworks on the market is maintained or increased. An artwork like that is therefore, it's supposed to be a satire on wealth, but it's also an image of his own obsession with wealth. And what he says and what his fans say is, this is someone kind of engaged in a sort of Andy Warhol style life as art. It's a performance, it's ironic. And there's something quite alluring about someone who's so, so ironic and so up themselves. But ultimately, it produces just complete cynicism on the part of the vast majority of people because they just see someone playing games. And so it means that, the YBA is, trying to create this this movement of populist avant-garde experimentalism, radicalism, which lots of people want to hear about and listen to. That's why they say.
I definitely got that sense when I watched that interview again, that he's definitely sort of in love with his own idea of himself, and that's his brand and that's his that's what he was trying to push. But let's continue. So over the past few years, there's been a reassessment of the 1990s as an era of opportunity and positivity and liberalism. So why do you think that is? And why does it matter now?
So, in terms of reevaluating music over that time, in Britain, reevaluating 90s music has been, it's a kind of a constant process. It's not just happened recently. And that's because, Britpop classics have always been popular. They probably will have a resurgence at some point into being kind of really fashionable again, as opposed to just kind of played at people's parties or whatever. But at the moment, guitar music is so absent from the charts. I think it's kind of hard to imagine Britpop becoming like super retro fashionable again. And actually, what's more, if we sort of ask ourselves which older bands are more popular now, it's post-punk, you know, that's the kind of guitar sound that people are referring to more. And I guess that's because it's, you know, it's that little bit more dancey sometimes, or it's more electronic. So it's more relevant to contemporary sounds. And also, you know, that era, post-punk, much more melancholic, much more kind of critical perspective, and that feels much more relevant to our political and cultural times. It's not that Britpunk was all optimistic, you know, but the point is we remember it that way, so it doesn't feel quite
right for a time. I've been kind of immersed in Britpop because I'm later today I'm going to be interviewing another author who's just wrote a book called I Was Britpopped. And it's a Britpop anthology, basically, kind of an A to Z. Yeah, it's a really great book. But I was reading it and I was just like, oh my gosh, all these bands that I used to know and just completely forgotten. And so I've been going back and watching them on YouTube. And so I've been kind of immersed in Britpop. It, you know, not all of it was good, actually, to be fair. But, you know, it was my era. So, you know.
Exactly. We all have we connect to it in a really meaningful way. And then, you know, you were asking, you know, kind of reevaluating the 90s generally as well as music. You know, I think that reevaluation of what happened in the 90s in the whole of British society, that's been happening because of the political and the economic turmoil that we've been experiencing ever since the 2007 crash. So that's a whole decade that's been happening. You know, the 2007 crash, and then, you know, being followed by austerity or recession, and then austerity, and then stagnation because of austerity. You know, that crash, it destroyed the Labour government that had been in power since 1997. When the next election came along in 2010, that's when Gordon Brown, who had taken over from Tony Blair, that's when he got kicked out. And, you know, first that 2007 crash and the sudden realization that things were not okay and that all of that optimism of 97 had been completely, you know, been not completely empty, but there had been a lot of emptiness to it. First, it destroyed the veneer of liberalism that New Labour had constructed. And it really kind of unleashed a lot of anti-migrant propaganda in the right-wing press, and a lot of that really, you know, encouraged anti-migrant feeling as well. And gradually, more gradually, because of a lot of anti-austerity campaigning, to be clear, austerity is the massive program of government cuts that's been instituted since 2010, which has caused enormous pain and suffering for working class people and lower middle class people in Britain. You know, it's really about taking away benefits and public services that people really depend upon, at the same time as there being complete stagnation in the wages that people are earning. And because of, you know, people fighting against austerity, now, as well as it, the 2007 crash having destroyed the veneer of liberalism, now the impact of that crash is just eating away at the neoliberal consensus, you know, the free market economic assumptions that have dominated British politics since 1979, when Mrs. Thatcher came to power. And so 10 years after the economic crash, we've now got a political centre much more economically socialist, with someone like Jeremy Corbyn being more and more popular, but also much more socially conservative, with someone like Nigel Farage having made inroads.
So was there anything from 1997 that you think we got right, or an idea that was prominent in 1997 which we discarded for good?
You know, I think New Labour, trying not to make it entirely about New Labour. You know, whether it's New Labour or the Spice Girls or Britpop, all of these pointed to the idea that actually the vision of Britain as a fairer, more welcoming country is actually an enormously attractive one. You know, we're so used to, over the last few years, thinking of like Britain's on the way out, Britain's closing down, Britain's closed for business, these kinds of things that we hear. And actually, you know, it's only 20 years ago that we were saying our country doesn't have to look to the past to think of itself as being a good and great place, that there is something very welcoming in our political, in our national history. We, you know, haven't got everything wrong, and that we can be a more tolerant and a more cosmopolitan society, that we can be a fairer society where the state supports working class people and people who are having a very hard time. That's you know, that optimistic, more egalitarian idea of what Britain can be, that's not totally made up. That's something that attracts a lot of people. And I think that that can become popular again. But I think what the thing is that it's got to be backed up by real will and real action. I don't think the kind of compromises that New Labour represented, that all politics involves compromises, but there were too many with New Labour. And you know, a lot of people look to the Labour Party still. They look to Jeremy Corbyn, his very kind of radical vision. And they say, maybe there is the optimistic outlook for restructuring in Britain in a way which is much more fair and which gives a lot more freedom to people. And, you know, at the same time, again, some of your listeners will know this, some won't. There's been a very kind of exciting thing happening on social media with lots of grime artists. Grime, who we don't know, is kind of London's answer to hip hop. That's what a writer called Dan Hancock's called it. It's, rappers, but with kind of like usually emceeing over kind of very broken beats. So a genre that's been going in Britain for a long time, but been really popular in the last few years. Lots of grime musicians have started really supporting Jeremy Corbyn, you know, kind of like the coolest people in the country, supporting this, like, in some ways, very kind of staid and kind of avuncular guy. And so maybe there we're seeing, like, in the same way that perhaps Jeremy Corbyn represents a more real version of the optimism that New Labour tried to create. Maybe in the same way, you know, grime MCs supporting him is a bit like Noel Gallagher supporting him. But again, it's people who really do come from extremely marginalized communities and who continue to experience lots of racism supporting Jeremy Corbyn because they see him as a...
So that was the grime for Corbyn, wasn't it? The hashtag grime for Corbyn. Yeah, I followed that when that was happening, actually. And yeah, I was pretty happy with that, actually. That was a really good thing.
It was a pretty extraordinary thing. I mean, we've not seen anything like that in British politics for a long time. But then, you know, we haven't seen
it. No, but it also it was happening in the US as well with Bernie Sanders. And I can't remember that there was a hip hop artist who would him and Sanders would just sit down and talk back and forth for just you know, like a whole hour. I can't remember his name. I shouldn't have brought it up if I can't remember the name. But anyway, yeah, they're just really great. So, you know, it was happening with in the US as well, which is not at the same time, a little bit before. But yeah, that was really good. So let's talk about how 1997 planted the seeds of Brexit. So for those who don't know, Brexit is the UK leaving the European Union, which we joined in the early 70s. What do you think contributed to the UK leaving the European Union that stems from 20 years ago?
So I would say that what happened in 97 was that, you know, partly because New Labour had come to power, but also very much because there was this feeling of optimism that Spice Girls and Britpop were very much part of. There was this sense of, we now have the opportunity to solve some of the kind of fundamental problems in our society, you know, imbalances and inequalities. And there was a lot of hope that that was going to happen. And basically, those problems were not solved. And I think a lot of those problems are the ones that have led to Brexit. You know, there was this feeling of we're going to create a more generous and a more equal society in terms of class and socioeconomic inequality. And one of the upshots of that, hopefully, would be the migrants and ethnic minority communities wouldn't get scapegoated anymore for problems that they didn't cause. But instead, you know, what happened under New Labour, there definitely was, you know, for instance, an increase in social spending. There definitely was a massive reduction in the number of people living in poverty. But a lot of the time, what New Labour did was actually quite superficial. And so, for instance, the industrial communities, the mining communities and the docking communities who had been kind of crushed by Margaret Thatcher, those people needed a lot of support because they'd been so kind of like aggressively attacked for decades by the people in power, and they weren't given that support. And no surprise, you know, those neglected industrial communities are the ones who across Britain voted in the largest numbers for Brexit, because those are the people who've been fundamentally let down by the political and the economic system of this country for decades. And you know what? They were given a choice, like, do you want things to continue as they are, or do you want there to be a fundamental change? And okay, Brexit may not actually end up helping those communities very much, I'm afraid. But the point is, it's not very surprising that people who've been let down over and over and over again by successive governments, it's not very surprising that they say, yeah, let's have a really big change. Maybe it will make things better. It's, you know, and it's not very surprising that Brexit is the way that that gets expressed, because a lot of the time, actually, New Labour, especially Tony Blair, you know, he really tried to use nationalism to promote his extremely international political program. You know, he often would scapegoat asylum seekers and, you know, these people who've come to our country asking for help because they're being oppressed in the countries that they come from, and then being treated incredibly harshly, being given very, very little support, being, you know, constantly criticised in the media. And New Labour absolutely encouraged that in loads of ways. And, you know, that refusal by New Labour to stand up and have solidarity with people like that, it's just not very surprising. The backlash against the people in power has been a very nationalist one.
So I think, you know, from my angle anyway, your book does end on actually quite a positive note. You seem to conclude that some of the radical ideas that were presented in music, politics and pop culture in their watered down form are still in the minds of the people who were young during those years. So what can we learn from our mistakes? And do you see any hope in the current situation in the UK and any hope for the future of the UK?
Well, I think, you know, if there's a lesson to be learned from 97, it is that, if you're going to kind of give people hope, they're going to get disappointed unless you back that up with some radical action. And it's also that if you don't deal with like fundamental injustices in your society, eventually people are going to get angry and there's going to be a backlash. But one of the things that's kind of interesting with 97 is that, of course, you know, whether it was Tony Blair talking about creating a fairer society or the Spice Girls talking about feminism or anti-racist campaigners talking about fighting racism or Britpoppers talking about kind of the voice of working class Britain being able to express itself, these ideas seeped into our culture. And even if they were not acted upon, you know, even if we have not got a significantly less sexist society, you know, violence against women, whether it's by their partners or by other men, it's still incredibly common. Women are the ones who've been hurt by austerity. Racism is still a very big problem in our society, and you know, police, whether that's police racism or kind of the massive class gap between minority communities and white communities, these problems absolutely still exist. But the idea that that is totally unjust, which was really encouraged by those ideas coming into the mainstream in 97, the idea that those injustices have to be addressed, much more pervasive. And I think that is why we're now seeing, you know, it's partly to do with Corbyn, but it's also about activists on the street. We're now seeing a lot more anger and a lot more insistence that those problems are dealt with. And that gives me a lot of hope for the future. It will be a very tough battle to deal with some of the most kind of like pressing inequalities in our society. But at the moment, you know, we've got hope that it can be done.
I think those questions are, you know, those difficult questions are being asked now. You can kind of see it happening in Hollywood with the sexual assault allegations again. They're coming up, and you know, those conversations are being had now, which I think is really, really a good thing. I want to ask you what any future plans for yourself? Have you got any other writing projects on the go, or any documentary projects?
This is always bad with this stuff. I've got documentary projects I don't think I can talk about in public, but I've got a book which I'm just starting to develop. It's about reform and revolution through history. It's kind of the same topic as the 97 book. You know, the 97 book is about radicals coming into the mainstream. This is about revolution and reform throughout history. You know, when is the right time to have a radical struggle and to really fight against the system? And when is the right time to negotiate with people in power? It's all about that question of, you know, what's the most effective and the kind of just way to build a better society?
You should also work on that book on Oasis, the late Oasis book as well. Try and justify some of that. I really want to thank you for coming on the podcast today, Richard. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you today.
Oh, real pleasure for me. Thank you very much.